So this week we are in chapter 6 of the story, The Wandering. And last week Pastor Rick talked about Moses and how God gave his people his commandments and established the ground rules for how they could walk with him at Mount Sinai. And then the week before that, we talked about how Moses led them out of captivity in Egypt, and they were on their way to the Promised Land. But it was not nearly as simple and quick of a journey as it should have been. Who loves a good road trip? Anybody? I think most of us can appreciate a good road trip. I got surprisingly few hands. I don't think everyone represented. Who loves a good road trip? Okay, good, good. Because there was like four people that raised their hand, and I was like, really? Am I that strange? But turns out, more of us appreciate it than usual. Now, if you have kids that are grown or like junior high or older, you'll appreciate this. Who's ever been on a road trip with small children? Several of us. Brandy and I were on a road trip one time with our kids. Our oldest son was 4 years old. Our daughter was 3. And our little guy, Ezra, he was maybe 10 months old, not quite a year. And as we're traveling, I think we were en route from Portland home. He was done. He was not having it. Like, we tried feeding, changed the diaper, crying, went to screaming, and there was no stopping it, right? Many of you can relate to that. Well, the problem is when you have a 10-month-old screaming and a 3-year-old in the car next to him, like, eventually they're going to run out of patience for his screaming, and they're going to initiate their own screaming. And, you know, our older son was 4 years old, and, you know, he could only take so much. So eventually he's like sobbing in the backseat and asking about every 12 seconds how much longer it's going to take. And this went on for like a couple hours, like no stopping, right? Just maximum volume. I tried turning up the radio, but then they just scream louder. And I look over at Brandy and I realize the kids are long gone around the bend and I can just barely see her. She's about to like burst into tears too, right? She's with her. And then I looked over and we made eye contact and then we just burst out laughing. And our kids' mission was accomplished. Like, we actually lost our minds. So we burst out laughing out loud, and then what do? They scream louder because the older two knew we were laughing at them, and the younger one, just all the noise, like, they start screaming louder and louder. Like, we just literally went insane for a moment there. And honestly, Brandy's never really bounced back. She's not really in the room right now, but she can see me through the window of the cry room over there. So it's been a tough comeback. Many of you can relate to, you know, a road trip gone wrong. And some of you have little kids right now, so that's not even funny. Like, it's still a little too fresh for you. It will be funny someday, trust me. This is where Moses is at in this story, okay? Except his car's got 2 to 3 million crying children in it. This is where he's at, and we'll see later on in the story. Like, he actually will get to the point of kind of going a little bit nutty with God as well. When you travel, or at least when I travel, really the goal is not to get to the destination. The goal is to make good time getting to the destination. Have you ever been to a family reunion where people drove in from out of town? What's the first topic of conversation among the men? How was the traffic? How was the pass? So on and so forth. But what they're really angling for is, how long did it take you to get here? That's what they're working towards. And then, of course, the person they're asking will lie and say like a half an hour less than it actually took. And finally, one person will like come out with like the trophy phrase, "You made good time." Now, if you're a woman, you should know that telling a man you made good time is roughly equivalent to him telling you you look like you've lost weight. Just file that away. You may want to use that. And some of you are thinking, no, that's not true. Okay, well, if that's not true, then how come when you drive in a car with a GPS thing that says how long it thinks it'll take you to get there, your goal is to get there quicker than how long it thinks it'll take you? Or if that's not true, then how come when you went on a family trip as a kid, your dad got irritated when someone had to stop to go to the bathroom? Because it's about making good time. If you're leaving somewhere you don't want to be and you're going somewhere you do want to be, it's about making good time. If you're just cruising, that's a whole separate matter. But in this case, in the story, the Israelites are leaving captivity in Egypt and they're headed to the Promised Land. Now, captivity, Promised Land. They're trying to get somewhere specific. They're in a hurry to get there. They want to make good time. They're going somewhere important, but they're complaining about it the whole way. So far in the story, God made everything, and it was all good, but it didn't take very long for sin to come in and corrupt the hearts of men, and all of creation begins a downward spiral, to the point that God was sorry he had even made man, and he started over with one family, Noah and his family. And then we see 1,000 years go by, and not much really happens, and God begins building a nation through whom he will bless all of creation. And the person he chooses to begin that nation with is Abraham. An unlikely source. And Abraham has a son named Isaac, who has a son named Jacob, who has a son named Joseph. And we see in God's plan for this redemption that when famine sweeps throughout the land, God blesses Joseph through some difficult circumstances, and he sustains his people through Joseph. Joseph rises to prominence in Egypt, and God's people come there to live with him during the famine, and he takes care of them. Generations go by, and there's a new Pharaoh who knows nothing of Joseph, and he realizes, man, there's a bunch of these Israelites. We better do something about them before they outnumber us and take the place over. And so the nation of Israel, Abraham's descendants, they slip into a period of slavery. They make them slaves to try and control them. And then a couple weeks ago, God rose up Moses, an unlikely source, and led them out of that captivity. And of course, last week, Pastor Rick talked about how once God led them out of captivity, he gave them essentially the ground rules. He gave them the commandments and the sacrificial system and the tabernacle, all the things they would need to walk with God, to live in prosperity with God alongside him. And so today we're picking up the story where they've left that captivity and they're on a journey toward the promised land. Remember back in week 2 of the story, God said to Moses, I'm going to make your descendants into a great nation, and I'm going to give them a land, and it will be theirs forever. That's where they're going. We're 550 years down the road from Abraham receiving that promise, and they're still trying to get there. So I have to assume they're just getting a little bit antsy. They may be doing a little bit of screaming. But it's a really important point because it demonstrates to us that they really want to get to the promised land. So God has led them out of captivity. He's spared them from Pharaoh's army by parting the Red Sea. And he's explained to them the rules of the game. This is how life with me can work perfectly for you. And they're on their way to the promised land. So if you were leaving Egypt, I have a map for you. If you were leaving Egypt and you were headed toward Canaan, this is the route you would take, known even back then as the way by the sea, the way of the sea. Really well-traveled road, even in their day. Not a very long trip. If you were to Google map it, well, you don't have to because I've done that for you. It's roughly 200 miles. Depending on your exact starting point and ending point, it's roughly 200 miles. It's roughly the distance from Spokane to Yakima. And I know what you're thinking. Using Yakima as an analogy for the promised land is a stretch, to say the least. But they tell me it's the Palm Springs of Washington. Not that any of them have ever been to Palm Springs. But anyway, that's what they say. So this would be the direction that you would want to go. And if you pulled out your iPhone, because I'm assuming all of you are iPhone users, and you mapped the distance, and you used the little walking guy instead of the car, it would tell you that from my house in North Spokane, it would take you about 2 days, 20 hours to get to Yakima. That's less than I would have guessed. I'd probably be loathing getting there, so it might take me a little longer, but that's what Siri tells me. So 2 days, 20 hours. Now, this is a big group of people, a couple million of them. So let's assume that maybe they only traveled a couple hours a day in a caravan, and then they stopped to talk, right? Or they stopped to camp and talk. Let's assume that they were only traveling 2-3 hours a day. I mean, even at that, they'd still get there in a matter of weeks, right? It took them a little bit more than a few weeks to get there, not even close. So they head out of captivity going the complete wrong direction. This would be a possible journey, though. It's not that far. And one of the things we see in life is that when God is leading us through life, he often takes the roundabout way. Have you noticed that in your life, that you had a plan to get here and you went there? And, you know, maybe you still ended up over here, but it took a while. This is how God operates. Sometimes he takes us the roundabout way. The first intersection they come to, they should go northeast towards Canaan, but nope, they go directly south. The directions are hopefully right for you. I was trying to do that backwards so that it would make sense for you, but maybe I totally botched that. The good thing about this wandering is that God is leading them. God is going before them all the way, and he's walking with his people. So let's establish a definition. If the wandering is the time between where you started and where you wanted to go, sometimes God leads us in that wandering, but the time between where we started and where we wanted to go is usually the time in life when God develops our character. It's usually the time in life when God is building us up into what he would have us be. But the truth is, a lot of times it's a frustrating period. Usually when we're in the wandering period between where we started and where we want to be in life, it's not always pleasant. But as you look back at those times, as many of you can attest, when you look back at those times, you realize those are the times when I matured. Those are the times when I became stronger. Those are the times when I became closer to God. Now, my guess is that everyone here has either been in between or you are in between. There's probably no exceptions to that. The good news about that is we can look at this story and say, okay, how does this play out? How did the Israelites handle this? How did God act? And among the many questions that we have when we're wandering is we all want to know why. What is God doing? Why am I going through this? Why is this happening? And I think this story gives us a pretty good insight, a good opportunity to look through the window, see what they're doing, and really learn about what's happening right here. So I just want to read you a scripture from Exodus 13, verse 17. This is what it says. When the Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though it was shorter. For God said if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. Some translations say, so God led them the roundabout way. The Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle. And you remember a couple weeks ago we talked about Joseph when he died. He said to the nation of Israel, he said, someday God's going to come for us. And when he does, and he leads us out and takes us into the promised land, don't leave my bones here. You take me with you and bury me in the promised land. Over 400 years have gone by, and watch what happens. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear an oath. He said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up with you from this place. It's not really relevant to what we're talking about today. It's just kind of cool. After leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way. By night, in a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place from in front of the people. Sometimes we wander because God is leading us. Just like in this situation, God could have taken the direct route. He saw the white line on the map, but he led them in the roundabout way. Sometimes we get really frustrated, but there is one potential obvious answer to why you're going through the wandering period. Maybe God is leading you the roundabout way to develop something in you. So if you were going to the promised land, there would be a very short direct route, but this is where they went, the opposite direction. They went directly south towards Sinai. They went in the most opposite direction, really, that they could have. Why? Because God was leading them. So if God's leading you in the roundabout way, it's actually good news, right? God led them into the wilderness. He does that. They didn't like it. We don't like it. But God often does that. And this is where a lot of people end up in a crisis of faith. Maybe you've been there or you know someone who has. This is a period that really scares a lot of parents when their kids become young adults and they hit the wandering. I've been a kid forever, but now I got to figure out my own thing. They're in that in between period. Some people get really angry. Their solution is to get frustrated. There is no God. I hate Christians. I hate church. I'm out. Some people go there. Some people just sort of turn inward, kind of a self-loathing thing, like, oh, I'm just a victim to the sovereignty of God. I'll just wait it out. Some people, that's their solution. Some people will go into like hyper faith mode. We have entire television networks dedicated to this response where people will just like create internal faith as a way to like change God's mind about the situation. But I think the real question we have to answer actually has very little to do with the solution. The real question we have to answer is, if God's leading me into the wandering, am I going to follow? Will I follow where God is leading? That's a difficult question for us to answer. Will we say, I believe that God knows better than I do, so I will follow him through this. I will believe in him even when it's difficult. That's not an easy question to answer. It's really not. Sometimes we find ourselves in the roundabout way because God has led us there. And the way we really demonstrate our faith is when we decide, am I going to follow even though it's difficult right now? That is an unbelievable demonstration of faith. But here's something that we can learn from Israel's example. Remember that God took them the roundabout way for a specific reason, because he said that if I take them the way by the sea, they'll encounter war and they'll go back to Egypt. He took them the roundabout way for a specific reason, and the same is true for us. Following God through the wandering can mean a lot of difficult decisions. It might mean that I need to get more engaged in the Church of Christ than I want to be, or I might need to step out and reconcile a relationship that I don't want to reconcile, or I might need to be faithful in financial matters when it's not easy, or I might need to believe more in what God can do than I believe in what I can or can't do. It could be a million different things, but the fundamental question is, will I follow? We all have to answer that. Here's a little unfortunate reality about the desert. The desert is a really important place in your life. It's a really important place in my life. We get frustrated by wandering because we want to get to the destination quickly. But have you noticed that sometimes life feels like a perpetual journey? It feels like maybe there is no destination. Maybe I'm just going to keep wandering forever. Maybe this struggle is just going to go on and on forever. And the truth is, life is a perpetual journey. One of the really moving passages of Scripture in the New Testament, John chapter 14, Jesus tells his disciples, my Father's house has many rooms, and I'm going there to prepare a place for you. If it weren't true, I wouldn't have told you. But good news, if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you with me so that you can be where I am. The destination is with Christ in the presence of God. Life can often feel like a journey, and the truth is, it is. But if you're wandering and God is leading you, take heart, find hope, because he knows the way out. He's leading you somewhere specific. So God led them to Sinai, we saw on the second map there, and it was a pretty lengthy process. Altogether, from the time they left Egypt to their time spent at Sinai, it was about a year until finally it was time to head to the promised land. Let the journey finally conclude. A year had gone by, so instead of taking 2 or 3 weeks, it's taken a year. They've been to Sinai. It was great. They spent time with God while they were there. And I want to do a little Q&A. So I'm going to ask Riley to come back up here again. Yes, come on up, buddy. Now, you might be wondering, how come he only calls on Riley? He never picks me. There's only two reasons. One, because I'm either afraid that you won't be able to answer the question, or that you'll say something horribly inappropriate, and you can decide which one of those you are. So, Riley, how you doing, my man? Who are you going for in the game today?
Broncos.
Attaboy. Yeah, there we go. I was trying to be noncommittal in my response there. So here's what we're going to do, Riley. I'm going to read one sentence out of the Bible to you, and I'm going to ask you a couple questions about it, okay? All right. Deuteronomy 1:2 says, it takes 11 days to go from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea by the Mount Seir road. It takes 11 days to go from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea by the Mount Seir road, okay? How long does it take to go from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea if you take the Mount Seir road?
11 days.
11 days. Good. You nailed it. Way to go. Okay, this is the bonus question for all the glory. It's multiple choice. I'll make it easy on you. Do you think it took the nation of Israel, A, 11 days or less to go from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea by the Mount Seir road, or B, more than 11 days?
Less? I don't
know. Oh, wah, wah, wah. We have a nice parting gift for you, though. It took them more than 11 days. It took them 39 more years. Give Riley a hand. It took 39 years for an 11-day journey to take place. Only the Israelites could make that happen. No one else in all of history could do that. So we saw what the shortest route was on map number one, and then we saw where God led them down toward Mount Sinai. This is what the rest of their journey looked like. That's the route they took to get to the promised land. Now, here's the thing that's interesting about that. The first year, God was leading them. That was God's idea. But the rest of that journey, that was all them. That was all their call. They could have taken the direct route. Sometimes I think, man, if I'd known then what I know now, I mean, if I was making the call here, I'd just go straight. Well, they had that opportunity to make the choice, and here's what happened. They wandered like crazy. 39-year delay, and it was really the product of their own poor decision-making, and really more than poor decision-making, their disregard for God's instruction, their lack of faith in what God was going to do. Sometimes we get lost in the wilderness. Sometimes we wander in the wilderness because God has led us there. But most of the time, we're in the wilderness because we just got lost. We just got off the path, so to speak. It's not really rocket science for them because God just gave them specific instructions. So all you have to do is just, you know, follow the instructions. Just stay on the path, right? Nothing to it. Just follow God. That's all you got to do. Easier said than done. So here's what happens. This is what Moses went through as their leader. They're journeying along from the time they've left Egypt. God is literally providing food for them called manna. Every day he provides food for them. And, you know, you'd think they would have like this amazing outpouring of gratitude, but no, they complain about having to eat manna every day. This is their experience. So on page 72, it's in Numbers 11:4. This is what it says. Wait. We got to back up a page. The rabble with them, there's a word you don't see often in the English language. The rabble with them began to crave other food. And again, the Israelites started wailing and said, "If we only had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna." Have you ever heard someone say something so ridiculous that you literally have no idea how to respond? First of all, it wasn't free. You were slaves, and you were paid in fish. That was a good deal. You're right. I don't know why I didn't see that. Because I think we all agree that freedom means nothing if you don't have fresh cukes. Who wants freedom? So this is Moses' situation, right? You can imagine Moses is in the driver's seat going, "Oh my gosh." And this is a part that in the story where it gets a little difficult for us, right? Because, you know, you may or may not know that Israel really is sort of a metaphor for us, right? God's people. So when we read stories like this and we try to make personal application, like put ourselves into the story, we got God, you got Moses, the only person in the entire situation who's laser focused on God's purpose, and you got the whiny people of Israel. Which one of those three do you think you most likely are? Yeah. If you're laughing right now, you're right. If you're like, "I'm Moses all the way." You know, maybe you are the only person laser focused on God's purpose, but I doubt it. Moses heard the people from every family wailing, and he starts to go bonkers. Moses heard the people of every family wailing at the entrance to their tents. The Lord became exceedingly angry for obvious reasons, and Moses was troubled. He asked the Lord, "Why have you brought this trouble on your servant? What have I done to displease you that you put the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I give birth to them? I ain't your mama. Why did you tell me to carry them?" That's in the Hebrew. You can't see it there. "Why did you tell me to carry them in my arms as a nurse carries an infant to the land you promised on oath to their ancestors? For the love of you, tell me, where can I get meat for all these people to make them shut up?" That's Moses' conversation with God, plus a few of my own interjections. But he literally just has this outburst with God. "Why have you made me the only mature person in this entire nation? Just give me some meat so they'll stop bothering me." That's his response. He goes nutty, just like Brandy and I did in the passenger seat. So, man, there's a real-life application for me. This nation of Israel that he's leading, they sound like whiny, entitled teenagers. And if there's a more annoying thing on planet Earth than a whiny, entitled teenager, I am yet to find it. But Moses has got 2 to 3 million of them. That's what's happening. And all because God has horribly mistreated them and miraculously provided them food in the desert. That's just uncalled for. And that's just how the 39 years began. That's just the beginning. Over on page 74, it's in Numbers 13, it says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites.'" So they travel, they're getting close to Canaan, they're nearby, and God says, "Send some people in to investigate. Send people from each of the ancestral tribe." So 12 men, one from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. They're gone for 40 days investigating the promised land, and it depicts it as lush, as beautiful. And it's one of the things that describes, it says that they brought back a cluster of grapes that was so large, they had to actually hang it on a pole for two people to carry. Now, maybe that means it weighed 200 pounds, or maybe that just means it was really big, and so it was kind of annoying for one person to have to carry it. Either way, it was a really big cluster of grapes. And they describe it as beautiful. And this is what it says on page 75, Numbers 13:27. It says, "They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account: 'We went into the land to which you sent us, and it flows with milk and honey. It's beautiful. Here is the fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw the sons of Anak there.'" To sum up their report is, the promised land is awesome. It's everything we thought it would be. But the people are really big and the cities are really big, so let's just go back to Egypt. Let's just go back and have our fish. In fact, one of them, it's good to know some things never change, one of them even says, "Compared to the people there, we felt like grasshoppers." Because there's always a drama queen in every single group. Apparently that's been true throughout human history, not just today. But here's the thing. There's 10 spies that go in, and they come back completely faithless. Right? They're saying, it's us grasshoppers against the giants, and there's going to be grasshopper guts everywhere. But two of them, who will become prominent figures in the rest of the story, Joshua and Caleb, come back filled with faith. Because it's not good odds, giants versus grasshoppers, but God versus giants is pretty awesome in their opinion. They come back with a completely different report. This is what it says. "Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, 'We should go up and take the possession of the land, for we can certainly do it.'" Caleb's ready to go. He wants to leave right then and there. But the men who had gone up with him said, "We can't attack these people. They are stronger than we are." And then they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. All the negative people begin to say, "We can't go do it. We should just go back to Egypt. Let's get some new leaders and let's just go back to Egypt." And then again, lastly, on page 76, Joshua and Caleb try one more time. Caleb says, "Only do not rebel against the Lord and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them." But the whole assembly began to talk about stoning them. Even after that report, all the people want to do is get rid of Joshua and Caleb because they're going to take us somewhere that we're afraid to go. And the outcome of chapter 6, and you'll find this if you read it this week, is that really all that happens is all kinds of complaining. Moses' generation is sort of the generation that's leading. They're the patriarchs throughout the nation. And God finally says, "You know what, Moses? You and your entire generation, you're never going to see the promised land. You're going to wander around here in the desert until your generation is completely gone, and then I'm going to lead your children into the promised land." That was the outcome of their faithlessness. And it's really crazy because up until this point, we've seen all these incredible stories of what happened through people's faithfulness. But here in this story, we see the devastation that comes with people's faithlessness. It's really an interesting contrast. Next week, thankfully, we'll see Joshua lead the nation of Israel into the promised land, and they'll, by faith, start acting like the people of God for a little while. But this is sort of the story of the Old Testament, right? And just like every week, there's two stories really happening simultaneously. There's the high-level story, what God is doing, his plan for the redemption of all things back to that original state of being good, of being in perfect relationship with him. And that story's in a pretty dark phase right now. But what he's really doing through this process, he's detoxing his people. They just spent 430 years, generation after generation, in Egypt, surrounded by false gods, by idol worship. Imagine just the whole influx of confusing ideas they probably have. God is taking this time period to reshape them back into his people. And sometimes he has to do that for us personally. God's taking whatever time is necessary. Next week, it'll say they'll emerge from that period of darkness. So that's what's happening in the big story, in the high level. But right on the ground level, just right where you are, where I am, when I look at this story, what does it tell me about me and what does it tell me about God? It tells me that in this journey of faith, this life with God, there's always an open road going back to Egypt. Whenever I step out, whenever I begin to walk in faith, whenever I begin to trust God, whenever that pressure comes and I have to choose, will I follow you? There's always an open road to go back, to make the same excuses, to blame the same scapegoats, to go back to the same habits. That road is always there. You know what I'm talking about? There's always the opportunity to just do what's easy and not press ahead. But here's the tricky part. You may have picked up on the theme by now that life with God is a journey of faith. Throughout the story so far, there are specific details, but in general, he's not really asking for anything beyond trust me, walk with me, follow me. When Jesus, when he called his first disciples, you might remember this encounter, when he first follows them, what does he say? He doesn't tell them what to do other than to say, follow me. Just follow me. Just come with me. Just be with me. Hear what I have to say. Just follow me. That's what God is really asking of us. And when we get in these periods of wandering, there's really two reasons. One, it's because it's God possibly left. He led us there. If that's where you're at and God has led you into a desert place, be joyful about that. Find hope in knowing that if he led you in there, he will lead you out. But the truth for me, and I think most of us, is the overwhelming majority of our wandering is because we just got lost. And if you take an honest assessment of your life and you find that, yeah, you know what, that's really where I am. Know this, for Israel, it was only one step of faith to set the whole journey back on course. And that's true for you too. So before we go today, we're gonna take communion. Pastor Rick's going to come and lead us through that. But I want to encourage you, use the opportunity of communion to take a step of faith, to just take a step toward God, to redirect the journey back on his course.